With a deluge of music streaming services that let fans listen to songs for free, the digital download may be going the way of the CD and the cassette tape before it. So reports Victor Lukerson in Time magazine. He joins us this hour to talk about how Spotify, YouTube, and other streaming services have transformed the music industry by allowing customers to listen to whatever they want, whenever they want it, at little or no cost. Even Apple, the king of digital sales, has moved into streaming by launching the Pandora competitor, iTunes Radio. What does it all mean for music producers and musicians trying to make a living? The conversation starts on Midday right after the news from NPR. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Roderick's here. Thanks again for joining us. It's been more than a decade since Apple first introduced their revolutionary device, the iPod. Remember the iPod? When television advertisements began airing for the MP3 player, capable of holding then unprecedented amounts of music, many consumers thought it was the end of the continual format changes that had become frustrating and redundant as the previous decades required music fans to switch from the vinyl record, to the cassette tape, to the CD. But as it turns out, the MP3 is joining the cassette and the CD as the newest and obsolete music technology, as 2013 saw the first decline in digital music sales since that format was created. Streaming music, where songs are played from a service rather than downloaded to a computer or tablet or smartphone, is changing the way music is heard and distributed. Understandably so. The act of logging onto a site or app and merely clicking on a song you'd like to hear is as easy as one can imagine, especially when there is little to no cost to the consumer. YouTube is unofficially the most used service for streaming music, but other music streaming services have been gaining popularity in recent years. Internet radio giant Pandora, for instance, boasts more than 72 million active users now. Is designed to be a customizable radio station with artists appearing based on your taste. iTunes has recently launched iTunes Radio to rival this model as well. But the Swedish company, Spotify, has grown in popularity in recent years, just in the last couple of years in the United States, by eliminating the guesswork of Pandora-like services, allowing registered users unfettered access to Spotify's reported 20 million songs on demand for a scant $9.99 a month. This may sound great for music fans, but what does it mean for the musicians and the music industry? Pandora does not pay artists or record companies to provide their music, and Spotify's model pays fractions of a penny to the rights holder of a song each time the song is played. A little bit later in this hour of Midday, we'll be joined by one of the leading thinkers in this field, Dave Allen. Dave Allen is a musician himself, a teacher and a lecturer of digital design up in Oregon. We'll also be joined by Jimmy McMillan, co-founder and owner of the Baltimore-based Friends Records, which we'll hear about, and he's manager at Baltimore's popular record store, CD store, the Soundgarden, down in Fells Point. But first, to get a better understanding of what's happening in the music industry so that you actually understand what Spotify is, we welcome Time Magazine business reporter Victor Lukerson, who's been covering Spotify and the music industry for the magazine. Victor, nice to have you on the Midday Show.
Oh, thanks, Dan. It's good to be here.
Yeah, Victor had a recent story about Spotify and YouTube just killing digital music sales. We put a link to that story from Time Business on my Facebook page, so folks, you can read it there. But I'd like to go over that with you a bit, Victor. And if you don't mind, just from the beginning, I kind of capsulize what happened here in the last last couple of years with Spotify. Spotify's only really been on the scene since 2011 or so, and made such great headway so quickly. So maybe we can just talk about it for a moment, Spotify, so that folks who aren't subscribers understand what happens with that.
Sure. Well, Spotify is a Swedish company, actually, a new tech startup. They have 24 million subscribers right now, and basically the service allows you full access to their entire library of music. It's about 20 million songs, as you said. And people are basically able to choose almost any artist you want to listen to it on demand. There's a free version you can have where you can listen to music, any song you want to at any point on your desktop with ads. There's also a paid version for $9.99 per month. Mm-hmm. We can listen to all the music without ads and also have it on your mobile devices. Spotify also just recently added a new free version for the mobile devices where you can listen to songs, but they have to be automatically shuffled, so you don't have quite as much flexibility with that.
Now, you don't own the song like you did with if you pay through iTunes for a song. It's not done. That's a different model.
Right. It's all the songs are hosted in the cloud, basically. So Spotify, you just stream the songs virtually, essentially. So essentially, you're paying a subscription fee to have access to the music, but you don't actually own any of it at all. I guess similar to the way Netflix works for movies, basically.
The other day, Victor, I was holding in my hands a great copy of an LP, The Platters, from I don't know what year, 1960-something. And, you know, many of us held LPs in our hands. Then we held cassette tapes in our hands and CDs in our hands. And in this age, you don't really own it. You just listen to it. You sort of, it's on, the music is on loan to you for a few minutes, right?
Right. I think there's a trade-off, I guess, in that, in the sense that with Spotify, for instance, it's so easy to access so much music instantaneously, which is one reason I think it's popular. But obviously, there's something to be said for actually being able to have physically own something. There might be one reason that of all the media or the different types of music formats this year, LP sales actually went up 33%, which kind of speaks to the fact that people are so interested in like owning physical music. But maybe only in more of a sort of like a collector's sense than
right.
like actually practically like I want to own every single piece of music that I listen to.
Right, but the big news is that the sales in digital have surpassed the downloads. So let's talk about that. What you reported for Time.
Sure, digital track sales. So basically, the songs you download on iTunes decreased for the first time this year in 2013. So it went from 1.34 billion in 2012 to 1.26 billion last year. Meanwhile, streams, which is songs you stream either through Spotify, YouTube, Rhapsody, there's a lot of different services where you can stream music. The number of songs streamed increased 32% to 118 billion songs.
Okay, it didn't surpass it. I shouldn't use the word surpass. It's just that there was a decrease in digital track sales, an impressive increase in the streaming.
Right, and then I guess the metrics are so different because obviously you're likely to stream a song more than once. Same way you play a song more than once if you own it, you know. But so the metrics are very different, and the revenue model for each is very different. So people are streaming more songs, I guess, than they're buying songs, but it's hard to say which one people are really using to listen to more.
Spotify actually is paying for music. Is that correct?
Yeah, Spotify pays about between 1/6 and 1/8 of a cent per stream in royalty rates. So that's money that's going to be split between the songwriter, the record label, and the artists themselves.
Oh, I see. So that's not just 1/6 or 1/8 to the artist. That actually has to be split up even further.
Right, and then it's going to vary depending on the artist. So if you're like a Beyonce, for instance, you're probably going to have a better record deal where you get a bigger portion of the Spotify sales than if you're an indie artist.
Victor Lukerson from Time Magazine, would you describe for our listeners what the controversy is with Spotify?
Sure. Well, there are a lot of artists who feel that sort of this model where people essentially are still getting to listen to free music as they have sort of in the last 10 years with various piracy formats. People are still getting to listen to free music in that way, but it's sort of been sanctioned by the record labels through Spotify and these other services. And some artists feel that's like extremely unfair because it requires so many more streams to match the amount of money you would have made from downloading a song. Thom Yorke, for instance, who is the lead frontman of Radiohead, has come out against Spotify essentially saying that it's unfair to new artists. David Byrne of the Talking Heads has also come out against it. So there have been a lot of artists this past year who essentially said that we need to be trying to encourage people to pay for albums and songs directly, and not just sort of having them stream these songs where artists are literally making a fraction of a cent per stream.
Hmm. So there's a lot of fans out there, especially young ones, who just don't want to pay for music. Is that that's the core problem still?
Yeah, I think it is. The music industry starting in 1999 has been steadily declining through 2012. in terms of album sales and overall revenue, just because with Napster, later Kazaa, and other services, it was just so much easier to steal music, basically, than to go to the record store and buy it. I think there was a thought initially that digital sales, like through the iTunes store, would be able to combat that, because that's simpler, obviously, than going to the record store. But it's really through streaming that we've seen piracy decline consistently, because a service like Spotify, it offers a better value proposition in a lot of ways than piracy, because you get access to so much music. It's really easy to take with you on your phone. There's very little. Once you pay for it, it's all right there in front at your fingertips. So honestly, it's even easier than downloading. One of the people I talked to for my story said that the record industry basically needed to find a service that was better than free if they were going to combat piracy. And services like Spotify, in some ways, accomplish that.
Well, yeah. So just for the record, if you want Spotify without ads, it you have to pay for it. Otherwise,
right, if you have,
then that's the Pandora model too. You can get Pandora for free, but we can get rid of the ads if you pay. I think it's $10 a month or something.
That's right.
Yeah.
So these services are kind of a mixture of subscription based payments, and also they generate ad revenue, but they make a lot more money for musicians and for the record industry through subscriptions than versus the ads.
Victor, I'm glad you're with us today, because this really is an interesting subject that goes to the question of what you might call internet ethics colliding with artistry, the artist's imagination, the creation of music, the production of music, the distribution of music. We might ask our listeners, you know, are you happy to listen to Pandora or Spotify for free, knowing that some artist at the end of the line, or at the beginning of the line of production of the whole creative process, isn't getting anything for that? And in the past, we all, you know, bought records and CDs and cassettes and supported musicians. So that's sort of the big question we're going to be dealing with in this hour of the show. And we welcome calls at any time to talk if you want to talk about this today. So let me put out the phone numbers. Victor Lukerson's going to stay with us from Time Magazine. You can read again his story, Spotify and YouTube Killing Digital Music Sales. Find a link to it on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. Our phone number, 410-662-8780 is our number, the toll-free long-distance number. If you want to chime in on this subject, 866-661-9309. And the Midday email address for questions or comments that way, midday@wypr.org. When we get back, we'll hear from Dave Allen, a musician and digital thinker, to get his take on the controversy surrounding Spotify and these the pittance that it's paying out for music. We'll also talk with Jimmy McMillan of Friends Records, a small record company with a focus on Baltimore area musicians. All that when we get right back. Welcome back to Midday. Dan Roderick's here. We're discussing the music industry today, specifically the rise of streaming music services and the way they are changing the music industry. We welcome now to the show Dave Allen. Dave Allen is a musician who played bass for punk legends Gang of Four and later formed the band Shriekback. Dave Allen went on to work in digital design and branding. He's currently digital creative director for the Portland-based company North. He's also a teacher and lecturer at the Pacific Northwest College of Art. And he joins us today to give his perspective on the current state of the music business in this digital age. Dave Allen, nice to have you on the Midday Show in Baltimore.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We're also joined in the studio here by Jimmy McMillan. Jimmy is the co-founder and owner of Friends Records, a small record label with a focus on Baltimore area musicians. So we'll hear about that today. And Jimmy's also the store manager at Baltimore's very popular record store, the Soundgarden. Jimmy McMillan, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you for having me.
And Victor Lukerson still with us from Time Magazine. So, Victor, if you have something to say during this conversation, please chime in.
And okay, sounds good.
Yep. Dave Allen, I want to go to you on this and get your thoughts about this first. And I used a term that you used in an essay, the ethical internet question and the future of music. It's really, really fascinating. You wrote this last spring. This idea that, you know, we're all consumers, and most of us love music. Those of us who love music have to think about this a little bit. Do we expect it to be free? Are we willing to pay for it? That seems to be an ethical question when you sit down and, you know, punch up your Pandora app that you're getting for free or Spotify. So I wish you'd unpack that for us a little bit, Dave.
Yeah, I'll try. Before we start, by the way, I just want to clarify what I actually do. I'm a digital strategist, not a designer.
Okay.
And I do work at North. And I am a lecturer at the University of Oregon, primarily PNCA. I do occasionally here in Portland.
Okay, thank you.
I think that original essay came out because of a certain musician who dislikes me a lot because we don't. I think we agree more than he would ever admit. But, you know, if you're going to talk about a construct like the internet having its own ethics, then you're getting into deep trouble there. It's a construct. It only humans can have ethics. And you're right. You know, what I'm trying to point out is, hey, let's get people to pay. And on that note, I want to talk about scale, actually, and I want to talk about a third way. Because I think that what we're really running into is the rhetoric is awful out there. And, you know, Victor, I'm not going to be rude, but I'm just sensing, I haven't read your article. I'll go take a look at it after the show. But when we have Tom York and David Byrne, who I had to write a rebuttal in The Guardian, and I say I had to, I just felt that why are these two amazing musicians who I have great respect for telling us, or at least putting out strange headlines that, you know, Spotify is destroying the music business and the internet is sucking up all creativity in the world? It just sounds like Google bait to me for headlines on websites. And what I'm trying to get at there is the music industry has always been very difficult for artists to make a living in, and I am a living proof of that. And it would seem that when I go out there and admit that around about 20 years ago, Gang of Four scaled back. We just weren't selling enough music. We couldn't actually survive with our families to, you know, stick at just trying to sell records. We made more money from touring, that's for sure. And I think that when musicians complain about the setups with, say, Spotify or Pandora, they're really missing the point. They ought to be complaining about the recording contracts that they were never forced to sign, but they did sign. And in those recording contracts, this licensing fee problem is in there. Spotify, as we know, pays over 70% of its income to the record labels. And from there, I think Victor had pointed this out very clearly, which is a good thing, is it all gets split up across publishers and writers and all sorts of, you know, your managers, your agents, people getting their hands on it. But I want to talk about scale, though. Just imagine more people listen to radio for their music access for free than you could count. You know, I mean, we're talking hundreds of millions, just even globally. What if we could just persuade 40%, I'm just throwing numbers around, Say we get 40% of those people to transfer over to paying $9.99 a month for the service, at roughly $120 a year. When I was at Intel, people I noticed in all the research back in 99, 2000, that on average people bought about 3 CDs a year. You know, it's not a massive market. It's getting smaller for sure, but it was never. There was never this golden era of major income for artists who had to start at the bottom and work their way up. Now, I'll wrap this one up by just saying, look at who's doing the complaining. I'm not hearing it from all the young people who are doing very, very well online and have just taken to the platform very quickly, managed to give away albums online and then fill shows and make an awful lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
All we ever hear about is Spotify's terrible, YouTube's terrible, you know, there's Mog, there's RDO. I think we need to change that rhetoric and find a third way to discuss this. And that's one of my goals in 2014 is to, I'm actually heading to Europe on a talking trip to just begin to try and say, come along, bring your questions, you know, like a town hall meeting sort of thing, and we'll try and just try and change it. Because in a decade, I swear, I feel strongly in a decade, we could make the recorded music industry much bigger than it's ever been by persuading people to pay for access to this music that they don't need to own. They just want to rent it. But let's get that $10 a month out of 100 and 200 million people. There's an awful lot of money there.
Let me talk to Jimmy McMillan about what Dave Allen just had to say there in terms of scale and the opportunity that this could potentially and eventually present for musicians. Jimmy, what do you think about that idea?
For younger artists in particular, I think it's exposure is the most important part of it. Mm-hmm. Streaming through your computer, through your phone, or through your iPod is pretty much the equivalent of the modern day FM radio. FM radio didn't pay a whole lot. Your song got played on the radio. You were just excited to hear it on there. You didn't expect a big check in the mail for it. To have your song streamed for young bands, that's still the exciting part of it. For older, David Byrne, Tom York, people who didn't have this included in their original record contract, and when it got restructured, they probably didn't pay a whole lot of attention to it. They were surprised to see their song got played 10 million times, and they only got, you know, $400 for it. That's
shocking.
Shocking to them. Right. Yeah. Whereas to young people, they're more excited that their song got played 10,000 times. You know, right. they're not as concerned with the final number, because that does translate into, as it always has, touring. Bands have never made their money through exposure. They've always made their money through directly going out and touring. It happened in the early 80s and in the early 60s, and it's always been in the outlet for major revenue through T-shirts, through ticket sales. Any way that a band can make money in their hand. If it has to go through the record label, you're going to get just a percentage of what that dollar is.
And what did that same generation of those musicians, their peers who are not musicians, who are just the customers, so to speak, right? How do you convince them to pay, to get the scale up where it's actually, you know, you can support yourself as a professional musician doing this?
If the music is memorable, if the music is good enough, people are going to go out and seek it out, whether it's through iTunes or whether they find a record store and they buy a copy of it, or they click online and either find your record on Amazon or eBay or wherever they have to go to find a copy of it, you know, whatever's accessible, they're going to want to have a copy of it to show to their friends, to put in their collection, to grab for their Sunday drive or whatever. It's going to last. But if it's just streaming for in a store, if it's just in the background while you're writing a paper, if it's, you know, just superfluous, it's just radio. It's the same as FM radio was.
I want to go back to Victor Lukerson for a minute from Time Magazine to let him maybe respond to some of the things Dave Allen said, but also to make it clear that from your most recent piece, the story of January 3rd that we've alluded to here, you say, make no mistake, this model is the future. This is the way it's going to be. Go ahead, Victor.
Right. Obviously, I'm talking about them killing digital sales. It's more about like a transition to streaming versus necessarily being like a negative thing. Although record labels are really committed, I think entire industry is committed to this streaming concept. In addition to Spotify and Rhapsody, which exists now, Beats Electronics, which makes it popular Beats by Dre headphones, is prepping their own streaming service to launch really soon. YouTube, who you mentioned at the top, is the most popular streaming service right now. Is going to have a paid subscription service this spring. There's a French company called Deezer, which is also coming to America soon, which offers basically the same service. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of like, from all corners, you're seeing all these different services that are going to appear and sort of try to convince people that they should pay for access to the music. And I think the general hope is that eventually people become so used to the concept that they'll be willing to pay for the paid services of this. And with scale, as David mentioned, there could theoretically be even more money to be made. If you have a Spotify subscription and you pay $120 per year, that's basically like buying 12 albums, which only the most avid music listener does. But because I guess the payment method is so much less painful, you know, you don't really think about paying $10 a month if it's just your credit card or whatever. There's a thought that they can make it so that people would be willing to pay more for music without even really thinking about it that much, basically.
I want to go to the phone lines and take a call here, and any of our guests, Dave Allen, Jimmy McMillan, or Victor Lukerson, can respond. This is Scott, who's calling from right outside of Baltimore in Nottingham. Scott, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks.
Go right ahead.
Yep. I just want to say that I'm an independent artist, and I'm not really, you know, I joined Amazon and Spotify just to try to get the music out there. Spotify has literally paid me 1 cent since August, but I'm not so much concerned with trying to, you know, pull a check from Spotify right now, rather than get the new album I put out, you know, as heard by as many people as possible. So vast, how many people can find music now, and that's the main thing I want to do, have like a related artist. Maybe they find a mainstream artist, so to speak, and then I'm, you know, associated with that, where they, you know, this artist sounds like such and such. But, you know, I never joined Spotify thinking, oh, this is going to, you know, pay my mortgage.
Right. Let me ask you a question, Scott, and then I have a question for our guest. So
sure.
are you a solo artist? Or are you in a band?
The album was recorded as a solo artist, but I have a band now that we go out and we try and play as much as we can. But we also have day jobs where it's not like we can give up the money that we know we can make versus money that we might be able to make go out and play.
Understood. And was your music produced here in Baltimore?
Yeah, I produced the record myself.
Okay. So here's my question, and I'll go to Dave on this. Dave, like, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, what would someone like Scott, what would have been his situation? How much exposure would he get? How would he have gotten his music out there 10 or 15
well,
years
he,
ago?
He would have trouble. And I think it's a very, he's put this across in a very clear way. When Gang of Four first came to the United States, all we had, if we were lucky, was to get played on college radio. There was no MTV at the time. We could never get on FM radio. So we had to work. We were doing 12-week-long tours where we'd do two shows a night in the worst bars in America, you know. But we were young. It was fun.
Yeah.
We made what money we could make. And I think Jimmy alluded to this as well in one of his responses was you know, if people discover you and, you know, being... how can I put this? Getting famous in the music industry is a mixture of talent and luck and charisma, if you like. You know, those three things mingle somehow and everything seems to come together. Others have that and don't make it. You know, and the amount of money that might come from Spotify, I'd like to just point out that's what I call found money right now. That money didn't exist before. I don't get hardly anything from radio play. You know, we paid back Warner Brothers $250,000 or more for videos that they gave to MTV for free. So why is no one complaining about, you know, Viacom is a massive profitable company that gets free videos from the record industry that the artists have to pay for? You know, there's all sorts of problems here, and it was never easy to make it. So I'm just trying to focus on that piece. Like, it was never easy. But now you do have massive scale of distribution. The income needs to be sorted out. And I want to find a way where artists are paid properly, but we're still hamstrung with the recording contracts that they already signed. Like Gang of Four with EMI and Warner Brothers, we lose 50% off the top of any licensing. So if the songs are licensed to Spotify, we lose 50%. The label keeps that 50%. If we could change the wording in the contracts to not be licenses, we might find ourselves with a better royalty rate. But at the end of the day, as our caller here has said, it's you don't have to be in these services if you don't want to be in them, but they are amazing currently for exposure. And I would like to think in 10 years' time, I think Victor would agree too, is that we can actually increase the size of the revenue streams that come from recorded music, for sure. And you know what? I said this yesterday on a panel at CES with Hank Shockley and a few others, and we were just talking this through. It's like when that money starts to flow properly and you start seeing it, it'll be a different rhetoric. But in the meantime, it might be best for musicians not to sign any record contracts whatsoever. Like, have a hiatus there and just try and sell everything yourself, because the labels are like the bank. It's great. They can help you get your record made. But if you can get your record made yourself and you own all of your own copyrights, you're going to be in a much better position when the tide changes and the money really is flowing.
Let's go to Jimmy McMillan. Your comments on that and what you instruct young musicians who want to get produced.
Whenever somebody comes to me with the idea of putting a record out, I always encourage them to put it out themselves. I split the profits of every record after costs with the artist. I also don't have any contracts. But when it comes to something like Scott's album, if that had come out 10 or 15 years ago, his exposure would have been limited to the area. He might have been lucky to get on a local talk show or radio show. He may have been lucky to play a music showcase or win a battle of the bands, but that's regional. You're looking at, you know, the tri-state area. Now his record is up not only through Spotify, but through Amazon and Rhapsody and all these iTunes, and it's available in Portugal and Japan and Africa. It doesn't matter where it is. It has the potential to be listened to, and that's the important part, is just that people hear it, at least to artists. As far as a revenue stream, the bigger it gets, the more sharks that are going to come into the water and look for, you know, more food. That we've gotten a lot of them out of the industry through, you know, there. You say there wasn't a golden age for revenue, and it really was in the 90s. CD sales shot through the roof, and I don't know how yours were, but everybody else seemed to just be rolling in money. They were throwing it around.
Yeah, but that's a really good point. But it's what I call a bell curve, though, where we were replacing our vinyl albums for our digital versions. Because there was also a big bell curve in, you know, when the Rolling Stones would just use one promoter, for instance, and ticket prices for shows went through the roof as well. And now if you look at that bell curve, it sort of all seems to have come back down to where when we signed to Warner Brothers back in 79, I think, you were signed because they wanted very credible artists. And if you could sell 500,000 albums, awesome. And they'd stick with you even if you didn't. And then we got that weird bell curve. And now I think it's kind of flattened out again, where the revenues are lower again. But I'm very optimistic that I can see this growing, and perhaps a lot quicker than even a decade.
An email here from Steve in Baltimore shows that at least these same issues are on the minds of our listeners. His two questions are, if the deal is unfair to musicians, why don't the musicians refuse to license their work until they get paid more? That's one thing. His other question is, how is streaming audio, internet radio, different from old-fashioned radio? Listeners enjoyed the music and agreed to listen to the ads that paid the artists. What has changed? And I actually think the ads paid the artists, but in the radio, the old-fashioned, old-school radio format. The difference is, for me, and the second question, is that if you heard a song, you know, on the radio and you liked it, depending on what era we're talking about, the 60s, 70s, and 80s, you went out to a record store and tried to buy the album, or a single, maybe even a 45, depending how far back you go. Or a CD in the 80s and 90s, right? Jimmy, you're with me? That's the difference today, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what else to say about that, because that's the difference, I think. Maybe Dave wants to add something to that.
I'm not quite sure I fully understood.
Well,
he's saying,
what is the difference between listening to the radio on the internet and what we did in the old days, or still do, is listen to the radio on the music, listen to music on the radio in the car or wherever you are. How is it different? I'm saying, in the old days, you'd go to a record store and buy a record. Now, maybe you will download a song you really like. Maybe you do, if that technology even stays.
Yeah, I think that there isn't a lot of difference in terms of that behavior, except for you couldn't just hit a button and download an album from iTunes, you know, for $9.99. You had to go out to the store and physically get it. But I think that speaks to the demographic we're looking at here. Every year, actually every new term, so this afternoon I have a whole new class to teach. And I always start the class out just out of interest because of these kind of discussions. I ask them just a hands up, a simple, you know, there's 60 students, and just a simple show of hands is like, what is your top five favorite ways to access music? And I don't ask about free or paid, just what is it? And YouTube is like, you know, 70% of them, it's YouTube. Mm-hmm. Second is SoundCloud. Third is Spotify, roughly. And then there's a huge drop-off, right? So that's what I'm saying, is like, if we could persuade people to start paying. And I'm not suggesting right now at this minute I have the answer to how to make them do that. I just think we'll be having a different conversation. And I'd love to be able to say I'd come back in a couple of years and we're talking about this again, where things have shifted, where this idea that I think people seem to profess that people want music for free. I think that'll turn. I'm sensing it. It's like people are beginning to understand. It's like if we want to keep having access to great new artists all of the time, we have to support them. We have to help them get paid. And if that could just resonate with the buying audience again, if we could create another buying audience, I think we'll be. I know I'm sounding terribly optimistic about this, but one has to have faith. And I don't think the internet's destroying all culture and creativity. I think if you're a musician, you're often just pregnant with ideas that you want to get out there. You know, you're not going to stop being a musician. We just have to find ways to. I think somebody mentioned there as well, was it change the contracts, the email?
Or refuse to license their work until they get paid more.
But I don't think that you can do that. And I'm not an expert on copyright law, but unfortunately, if you're assigned to a record label, that your deal is now, you're in business at this point, right? And the business deal is that they're now available to exploit all of your recordings for sale. So I don't think you can stop them from licensing into these systems. And I could be wrong. If anyone out there listening knows otherwise, it'd be good to hear. But a contract's a contract. And right.
Dave, you know. We're going to take a break here, Dave. Dave Allen joining us from Oregon, a digital strategist out there in Portland, a teacher at the University of Oregon at Eugene, and with the Oregon branding company, North, is also a musician who's thought a lot about this particular topic. And we'll come back and talk some more about music in the digital age with Jimmy McMillan from Friends Records and the Soundgarden here in Baltimore, and Victor Lukerson from Time Magazine. You can join us. Comments or questions, how you feel about this, the ethics of taking it for free, or are you going to win over? Are they going to win over eventually, win you over? Are you going to start paying for music online? 410-662-8780. Michelle writes to us by email. She says, while I sympathize with the musicians, this is the new model for listening to music. It's convenient. It's easy. The music industry might have to change to accommodate this model. Perhaps a greater percentage from these apps should be given to the musicians and less to the producers, since their role is also diminished. I don't know about that, Jimmy McMillan. What do you being a producer yourself, I don't know if you would agree with that.
No, I kind of do believe.
Do you?
I believe that exposure is the most important part of it. The whole reason to put records out. I spent 20 years working in record stores, watching friends, mostly musicians, work in record stores. And I'm not a musician myself, but they would get record deals. They get promises. They would even get their records put out, and they would not see a dime. Some cases, like Gang of Four, owed money. They would owe their record label money just for putting their record out. Hmm. And I watched it happen too many times, and the opportunity came up to be able to put records out myself, and I started putting out the records of people that I know and people that I work with. And
that's what you do, Friends Records?
Friends Records.
Would you just, for our listeners' sake, here in Baltimore, tell us a little bit about your label?
4 years ago, I started putting out vinyl LPs of Baltimore-based bands. It's everything's, there's been 24 records put out, there's 56 cassettes now, and it's all it's all Baltimore artists. I think there's one that's from North Carolina. But
and are they online?
Everything is online. Almost everything is pay what you want. It's a model that we put up. Just I didn't want to do digital originally. I just wanted to put out LPs. My my label mate, who's younger than me, he's 30 now. He convinced me that we have to do digital. So the original plan was to put digital in with the LP. We put a download code. The first show that we ever did, a guy came up to the table and he wanted to buy the CD. And we said, no, it's got the download code in the LP. You can listen to, you know, make as many CDs as you want. And he's like, what am I going to listen to on the way home? Hmm. Oh, got me. Hmm. So we started putting CDs in with the LPs and wrote the digital off as not trash, but free money. We put it out there for free. If people, just important that they hear it. If they want to pay for it, they can. And that has been very good for
artist. Is that working out?
People pay.
Huh. Victor Lukerson, you still there with us?
Yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to thank you again for being with us today from Time Magazine. Just a quick question for you, sort of a broad question, but musicians generally, professional musicians, there's obviously griping about the returns from Spotify, but are they getting this, or is it a generational thing? What would you say about the musician's point of view on it?
I mean, I think in some ways it's generational, just because I guess for 50 years, like, recorded music was bought and sold in a very logical way, even through the digital sales, which have now started to drop off. But for a younger generation of musicians, obviously, if you look at the way that, like, some artists distribute the music for free anyway, particularly in hip-hop, mixtapes are really common. Indie bands often release their music for free, sort of like in a way to generate promotion for themselves. I think among sort of the younger generation, there's sort of like a understanding that people aren't necessarily going to be willing to buy specific albums or songs in the same volume that they were in the past. But obviously, I think there's a hope that if they can generate sort of a format that is worth paying for because you get so much content and it's so simple to use, people would be willing to do that. I mean, young people today are happy to pay $8 a month for Netflix. That's like what people would rather do than have cable.
Right.
So I think if you think about sort of that kind of streaming model, there's some sort of formula there where you create something that's so valuable that people would still be willing to pay for it, even if it's not necessarily a single CD or vinyl album.
Thank you, Victor, and thanks again for being with us today. I'll take another call from one of our listeners, Mitchell in Baltimore. You're on Midday Next. Thanks for calling.
Good afternoon. How are you today?
Okay, Mitchell, what'd you want to tell us?
Well, I just kind of wanted to I've been in the music – oh, I used to be in the music business for 25 or 30 years, and I believe our guest I know your guest very well. The problem with the music industry is they got greedy. They got greedy from the very beginning and until really the middle of the 90s or maybe even the end of the 90s. Their expenses were really high. They were paying out small royalties to their artists. They were keeping most of it. And all along, they could have reduced the price of the product that they were putting out there. They had the ability to do it. They even tried it at various times. So it's no surprise that we are in this mess right now. It is too bad. The artist does get paid less than they should, and probably even less than the record companies were paying them. But this all really stems from the greed of the record labels.
Mitchell, thank you. And Dave Allen, we could go back to the Napster episode and the Napster lawsuit, really, to look at that and the effect that it had on the public.
Well, you know, okay, digital strategist hat on. I call that a zero barrier to entry model. You know, the two Sean's at the time, they weren't thinking of raising money to license music. They understood technology where, you know, the MP3 could be split up into small pieces of files that put on, spread across many computers, so there was no central server. I, at the time, was general manager at eMusic.com, which had raised money on the stock market. We went public, and we had about $80 million to spend on our infrastructure and on licensing music legally. They didn't have that, right? But what we saw there was people were very excited to access music. Now, clearly, that's all free, so this is not a good thing. But at the same time, there were conversations that took place, I know this, within the recording industry and with Napster to do a lot of revenue sharing around advertising because of the millions and millions of users they had. And the labels walked away from that. And that was an awful lot of money they left on the table. And then they did the worst thing in the world, which is the biggest PR disaster I could ever imagine, is we're going to go out and sue our own customers.
Yeah, a great idea.
Yeah, that's not very American, last time I checked. Yeah. That was a lesson learned, perhaps. I think what we saw there was they would rather have put their heads in the sand and then hope it all goes away. But I think Victor pointed to this, too. It's like this is what's happening is where it's going, and it's driven by the music fans themselves. And we have to look at that and again, try and put these models around them that create more revenue streams for musicians.
Let's take another call. Yeah, Dave, thank you very much. Let's take another call. This is Dave in Baltimore. That's Dave Allen in Oregon. This is Dave in Baltimore. Go right ahead, Dave.
Oh, hi. How's it going? Just wanted to thank you for your show. It's really interesting. It's really cool to hear people talking about this. I'm a musician in Baltimore and also a music teacher. And I just wanted to say that it's really helped my job as a music educator to have Spotify as a tool, because when people come in and they want to learn certain songs, I can just sort of pull it right up and It's very convenient, and you know, be able to, you know, look at different versions and stuff like that. It's pretty, like, unparalleled the amount of access you have to just so many different recordings, and it's opened up things creatively as well. I you know, create music, and so it's you have a few mixed feelings about it, but overall, I think. You know, in the long term, it'll sort of help things out.
Thank you, Dave. Thank you. I appreciate that. I hadn't thought about that. Jimmy, go right ahead. Yeah,
Dave. This is Jim McMillan. I just have a question. Do you pay for Spotify or do you use the free version of it?
Oh,
I pay
question.
For the
use the free version.
Your free version.
Okay.
What do you think about paying for it?
The whole point to it is that you're profiting off of it. You're using it to teach your students who are paying you. It's the same way if I'm not an artist. I don't make money off art. I use Photoshop. I might not pay for it. But if I were to get a job where I made money off of my art, I would then feel obligated to pay for Photoshop.
I get you. Yeah. Is Dave still there?
Yeah.
Dave in Baltimore. Sorry, Dave.
Guitar teacher, Dave. I'm sorry.
All right.
Is he still? He's gone? Okay. We'll go to another call. But thank you for your point there, Jimmy. I appreciate it. Mike in Baltimore City. Go right ahead, Mike.
Hi, thanks for your show. Hey, I'm a recording studio owner, so I've certainly been impacted by the lowered revenue stream that's available to musicians to record, because obviously if they don't have money, they're not paying me. But you had a previous caller ask what the difference was between listening to this stuff on Spotify or anything else, any of the other streaming services, versus radio. And the big difference is, as far as certainly a consumer and even as a musician, is the availability and the access to so many possible listeners. Previously, when you listen to this stuff on the radio, that stuff was formatted, and you know, some of the same corporations that own the radio stations own the record companies, and it's kind of vertically integrated. You only hear what they think you want to hear, or only hear what they think you should hear. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a great thing. I agree with your one panel member that this is going to help usher in a better time for music and musicians.
Mike, appreciate that comment. And we'll go quickly to Angela. Angela, we're down to our last minute or so here, so please be brief.
Hello. I just wanted to comment on the last caller. My general comment was basically on the same lines as his comment was.
Oh, okay. You say there's your comment that came in from our associate producer here is that there's a chance of hearing new music that you might not hear from radio stations. Spotify is great for finding new music. I certainly agree with that. Dave Allen, I want to thank you for being on the show today. I'm going to share with our listeners the essay that I alluded to there that you wrote on this subject from back in the spring. And I'll get it on our Facebook page today. I certainly appreciated your insights on this. Thank you very much.
Can I ask you which one that is?
Well, there's the one, How Musicians Benefit by Being Artisans. There's that.
Actually,
think I should post a couple of these, Musicians versus the Internet, and the whole question about the Internet ethics and that you raised here. So
right.
it's good
the
stuff.
The Artisans one is a good one, if I may say so.
You may. Thank you very much, Dave Allen. Nice to have you on the show.
Thank you, and also thank you to Jimmy and Victor, too. That was a good discussion.
Thank you, David. Yep. Jimmy McMillan, co-founder and owner of the Baltimore-based Friends Records. You can find him down at the Soundgarden in Fells Point. Nice to have you with us, Jimmy. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan.
And Victor, good job on this story here for Time Magazine. Folks, you can find it on the Facebook page, more in depth there, from Victor Lucasen, who writes about the music industry for Time. Thanks, Victor.
Thanks, Dan.
Okay, and thanks, everyone, for tuning in. That's our midday for today. Nathan Sterner will be sitting in for me for the weekly review on Friday, and then I'll be back on Monday. So have a great afternoon, everyone. See you again tomorrow.